The Exchange Podcast is brought to you in part by your university system, including Granite State College, Keene State College, Plymouth State University, and the University of New Hampshire. Imagine what you can accomplish here.
The Exchange Podcast also gets support from the New Hampshire Chiropractic Association, an organization of professionals providing a non-invasive, non-surgical approach to healthcare, tailoring treatment plans to meet individuals' needs. Learn more at nhchiropractic.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. One third of the food we eat relies on pollinators, but the insects, birds, and even some mammals that pollinate our plants are in decline. And so today in The Exchange, what you can do to bolster pollinators, no matter what the size of your outdoor space is. Listeners, what do you want to know about how to cultivate a pollinator-friendly space? What are your favorite local pollinators and pollinator-attracting plants? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org, and our number is 800-892-6477. We have three guests: Emma Erler, landscape and greenhouse field specialist with UNH Cooperative Extension. Welcome back, Emma. Good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me, Laura.
And also with us, Donna Miller, a master gardener who runs Petals in the Pines in Canterbury. That's a nature center of native habitats, including a pollinator meadow and woodland trails. Donna also runs the New Hampshire Monarch Festival. And Donna, it's really great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Diane DeLuca, senior biologist at New Hampshire Audubon, where she oversees pollinator conservation projects and the demonstration garden there. And Diane, good to have you too. Thank you.
Thanks, Laura. It's great to be here.
Well, and listeners, you can find links to all sorts of resources, including those provided by Cooperative Extension, on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You can also find links to Petals in the Pines and New Hampshire Audubon's pollinator restoration efforts. There's a ton of information there. Again, it's nhpr.org/exchange. So, Donna, let's just start with the basics. Remind us what pollinators are and why they're so important.
Okay. Well, we do have seven different types of pollinators in New Hampshire, and the one that comes to mind first for most people would be the bees. And there are two groups of bees. There's the honeybee, and then there are native bees. And the honeybees are not from the United States. They came over with the settlers from Europe. But they're the ones that we know of, that people have beehives and they raise them for honey and beeswax. And then the native bees are the bees that were here before the settlers came. So they have co-evolved with the native plants from our area. Most of these are solitary bees, so they don't live in hives. A lot of them live underground, or they live in wood. And then we have wasps, which they're not as important pollinators, or as effective, I should say, because they have smooth bodies, unlike a bee, which is more hairy and can carry a lot of pollen, but they do pollinate somewhat. And then the next two, butterflies and moths, they'll kind of lump together. You know, we see them in the gardens, we see them outside, and they're big and fly around, and they're not actively pollinating. They are looking for nectar, which is deep down in the flower. So as they're drinking nectar for energy, they are accidentally pollinating as they go, because some pollen will stick to their wings and they can move it around. The next two I'll lump together, the beetles and the flies. They're just huge groups of insects. And again, they're not as effective, but just by their sheer numbers, they're moving pollen around as they visit the flowers. The last one is the ruby-throated hummingbird, and that's the one, the only bird in the group, and they go for the tubular flowers. And what all of these insects are doing is they are moving the male portion from one flower, which is the pollen, and as they travel to other flowers, that pollen gets moved around, and when it comes in contact with the female portion, it goes down to the pistil, to the ovary, and that's where fertilization takes place. And you get seeds and you get fruit development. And that's how we get more plants and food. And as you mentioned at the top, that a third of our crops need pollination for the food that we eat. And then also 90% of all flowering plants require pollination from insects.
Wow. So they're really, really, really important. And that's fascinating, Donna, to hear that huge group of pollinators, you know, not just honeybees and native bees and wasps, which I could have guessed, but butterflies, moths, beetles, which most people see and go, ooh, get off my flowers.
Correct.
And flies, yep. and so forth. Emma, here in New Hampshire, which pollinators do you think are most important?
I'd say for the most part in New Hampshire, the native bees are probably doing the most work pollinating. All those insects that Donna mentioned are helping out with pollinators or helping pollinate things, but the bees are the most effective pollinators. And they're not doing it on purpose, which is, you know, kind of interesting too. They're not trying to pollinate flowers. They're just there to gather pollen and nectar for their own uses. There are a bunch of different native bees that are in New Hampshire. I mean, some of the more generalist species that will visit a whole bunch of different, or I should say more generalist groups that will visit a whole bunch of different flowers or groups like the sweat bees, leafcutter bees, mason bees, and carpenter bees, and of course, bumblebees, which most people would recognize. All of these guys are really important. You're probably going to find them in your garden. And unless somebody is keeping bees near you, they're going to be doing the majority of the pollination.
Wow. So how are they doing, Emma? We hear about pollinator decline. What's the latest?
Well, we know that they're definitely in decline. There's evidence from, you know, global, national, even regional surveys that bees aren't doing all that well. Some species are. Some populations are actually expanding and moving further north as climate changes, or they're being accidentally transported by people or on purpose. But a lot more are struggling. And probably the biggest reason for that is land use change. With more development, we're, you know, eliminating habitat for bees. Certainly there's fewer and fewer native plants around with flowers that are extremely important for bees. So this is true across the country, of course, not just in New Hampshire, but any sort of development that happens in New Hampshire means a loss of resources for native pollinators. And then, of course, there are other things that impact these insects as well. Lots of talk about pesticide use, and there's still a lot of controversy over, you know, which pesticides might have an impact on bees, which might be okay. Jury's still out on a lot of that, but in general, we know that it's probably better for bees, the less pesticide we're using. And certainly for home gardeners, makes sense to try to use as little as possible, to have as little impact as possible on pollinators. And of course, I mentioned it before, but climate change in general is also, you know, something to be concerned about in regards to pollinator health.
Can you just briefly describe, Emma, please, how climate change may affect pollinator health? You know, is it heavy rain? Is it heavy wind? Is it, you know, wild temperature swings? What is it?
Some of it's based on just the habitat change that could come with that. Part of it for a lot of some species that are more specialists, you're looking at changes in plant communities potentially. So that's definitely a concern for a lot of bees. Also just with climate change too, we see some species, particularly invasive plants, having a leg up on some of the natives. When we have extreme drought, that native plants might not be as competitive in. Or wetter conditions, who knows? But there's just a lot of changes that these insects are not used to, and even the phenology changing. So changing seasons can have an impact.
Well, Diane, I want to fold you in too. So what about birds? How much do they play a role, either directly or indirectly, in pollination?
So there's only one true pollinator, as Donna already mentioned, and that's the ruby-throated hummingbird here in New Hampshire. And that's considered a true pollinator. They drink the nectar and then inadvertently move the pollen grains from one flower to another. But pollinator gardens can benefit many species of birds. And I know we're going to talk more about the details of pollinator gardens, but all species need four essential habitat requirements, and that includes food, water, shelter, and places to nest. And that includes all the invertebrates that we're talking about as well. So if you have a particular interest in birds, you can make your yard or your backyard or your landscape more friendly for birds. Creating a pollinator garden is one way. They can use the seeds that are produced in the pollinator garden. They can use any fruit that might be produced. And if you're particularly interested in birds, you can plant things that are more favorable for them, like fruiting shrubs in your gardens or even particular trees. There's a lot of research out there that using native trees like an oak instead of some kind of non-native tree will really benefit birds. Doug Tallamy, who I'm sure will come up in our discussion as we move along, has done research that shows that a native tree like an oak can support something like 557 species of caterpillars, whereas a non-native shrub might not support any.
Really interesting. Yeah, go ahead, Donna.
Yeah, and one bird, like a chickadee, might need 6,000 to 9,000 caterpillars just to raise one nest of young.
So, Diane, as you talk about hummingbirds, do they, this is a particular question, but some people like to put out hummingbird trays. You said that they're the only specific bird pollinator. People will put up hummingbird trays, you know, sugar water in the tray. Does that sort of decrease their appetite for flowers? You know, Diane, is that not a good thing to do?
A lot of times you get questions about whether you should feed birds, whether you should put out hummingbird feeders. I think the thought is that it just supplements what they already have. If we didn't put out a feeder, they would do well. If we didn't put out sugar water, they would do fine. But in a lot of ways, it brings them closer to people, makes people think more about what's actually out there and in their yard. And just the opportunity to see things fosters an engagement in conservation of all types. So I think it's more for us that we feed the birds, and it's a supplement.
Okay.
They would do fine if we didn't, but it's really nice to be able to see them up close.
Listeners, we are talking about creating outdoor spaces for pollinators today, and we want to hear from you. What questions or tips do you have for attracting these vital creatures, as our guests have described their incredible role in protecting our food supplies? Let us know by email to exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. Again, 800-892-6477. So, Emma, before we get into the specific plants, and I have lots of questions about that, what general type of habitat overall do pollinators need? And Diane described it a little bit too, but I'd like to hear from you, Emma.
Yeah, one thing that pollinators definitely need is open habitat where there's plenty of blooming plants. Deep woods isn't going to be a good fit for the majority of species because there aren't going to be that many flowering plants in that sort of area. But when we have openings, like the edge of a forest, a field, a meadow, even our own gardens in our backyards, these can be great places for a whole diversity of species to really find everything they need in terms of pollen and nectar. When we are planning for pollinators, if we're really trying to boost pollinators in our backyards, trying to give them, you know, a diversity of plant species is really important. So having a variety of trees, shrubs, a number of different perennial species that are ideally blooming across the entire season. So that means picking species that bloom in the spring, some that bloom in the summer, and hopefully some that will even bloom right up into the fall. And having patches of plants that bees and other pollinators prefer is helpful too. So rather than having just one of each type of plant, let's say if you have a whole bunch of asters or goldenrod plants that bloom late in the season, that's going to help attract more pollinators. It's also just going to give them more space to forage. So having this more natural, I guess, mosaic in your landscape is important.
Oh, I see. So don't sort of monoculture your flowers.
Exactly.
Wow. Donna, let's say that a listener might just have a very small front yard, or maybe live in an apartment and just have a little teeny, you know, deck or window box. What would you say to those people, Donna, about how they can help the pollinators?
Right, exactly. Even in small spaces, you can be very effective because planters, window boxes, that type of thing you can do. And again, you want to try to amass color like Emma was mentioning, you know, so you want to have rather than one of this plant and one of that plant, if you had a window box that had a lot of, say, alyssum or something falling over the edge, and then another maybe taller flower of a different color, you know, you want to have that diversity. And it is doable. There are people who raise rooftop gardens in New York City. And other cities, you know, where they can attract them in that way. And if you're doing it within your neighborhood and you encourage your neighbors to do it and you can kind of spread out, that's part of the biggest problem is the habitat fragmentation that we have going on because of development. We have taken over the insects' habitat and we've put in strange plants and strange flowers. And so we need to reintroduce some of those native plants and those things and provide food for them. And that's a good way to do it, is if you can do it among your neighbors, then you can end up having a much bigger space that will attract them.
Yeah, if everybody has just a couple window boxes, then there you go. It's right. 10 window boxes instead of two. How about you, Emma? What do you typically recommend for somebody who has a very small space?
Very, very small space. It's kind of the same thing. I'm definitely having them look for some sort of native small tree or native shrubs that have blooms. A lot of options there. And then I usually think of having more of a focus on perennials as opposed to putting in a lot of annuals. So even if you only have, let's say, a 10 by 10 space, you can, you know, at minimum fit, you know, a dozen different types of plants in there perennial wise, and just try to really plant across the seasons. And like Donna mentioned, you do want to focus more on native plants. We know that native plants tend to serve our native pollinators better. Although there are some introduced species or some non-native species that do provide good pollen and nectar, they just don't serve as a good place for the larval stages of many other insects, which of course are also important. So I would be focusing on having, you know, like I said, at least a small tree, maybe a couple of small shrubs, and then trying to choose, let's say, at least three different species of perennials that are going to bloom, one earlier in spring or summer, one in midsummer, and then one later in the season, so that you have good forage habitat for really the entire growing season.
Wow, what you just said is so interesting, Emma. So these non-native plants, you know, pretty as they might be, don't support the larval stages of pollinators. You know, I can imagine somebody buying them and saying, gosh, this creates a lot of really nice flowers. It'll be good for the pollinators. But you're saying maybe yes, maybe no.
That's definitely true. And it's true for a lot of other insects that aren't pollinators too. So I guess the group that we're usually thinking of in terms of pollinators that are going to be actually eating some of these native plants would be our butterflies and moths. And it's easy for a lot of gardeners to get upset when they see a caterpillar chewing on whatever their prized plant is in their landscape.
Right.
But if you can tolerate some of that feeding, it's actually a really good thing, because that means you're going to have moths, you're going to have butterflies in your landscape in, you know, probably just a short matter of weeks.
Huh. Okay. I'll think about that next time I pluck those disgusting caterpillars off my tomatoes. Emma, we might get into that a little bit later, but Diane, I want to bring you back in. Anything to add here about sort of specific plants that you like to support pollinators?
I think Emma and Donna covered a lot of that, but I'll just share out that we have a demonstration pollinator garden at the McLean Center in Concord, where we have a self-guided brochure that shares out the different plants that are actually in the garden, the different habitats that they might flourish in. And that's a great way to just go and take a look and see what's on the landscape there and see what might fit into your particular yard or small space or even larger space. I think Emma and Donna shared really nicely about how you can make a difference with a very small space. And that's one of the beauties of conserving pollinators and invertebrates. They only need a small space and you can make a difference. And research has shown that the public and small spaces that they conserve makes a huge difference in pollinator conservation. They're not like the big vertebrates where you might need some extensive landscape in order to make a change in their conservation. So it's really important to share out that everybody can do something, even if it's just a small container plant.
Yeah, that's good to hear. You don't have to be a master gardener. You don't have to have a huge yard. You don't have to sort of put a lot of work into it. Let's go to our listeners, all of you. I want to remind everybody that we are taking your questions, comments, tips about encouraging pollinators in your outdoor spaces. And as our guests have said, you can make a big difference if you have a big backyard or just a small couple flower boxes. Our number 800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, Mark's calling from Sandown. Hi, Mark, you're on the Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
So this winter, I was going through my scrap wood and I made about 15 pollinator boxes that I've been handing out. And I was just wondering if they are effective.
Tell us what those are, Mark. That's really interesting.
Well, you drill different size holes about 4 to 5 inches deep in wood and or bamboo. And then you put I've been putting a little roof over them to keep the weather out. And then I believe you put them 4 to 5 feet high facing south. And it's meant to attract single pollinators.
Wow. So it's like a little shelter, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Thank you for calling,
a little
Mark.
Nesting place.
Yeah, just as Donna said, that pollinators need food, water, shelter, and places to nest. Go ahead, Donna. I'm kind of fascinated by this idea of pollinator boxes. I had not heard of that.
Yes. So something you can especially go to Pinterest and just put in Bee Hotel. And you'll find all kinds of pictures. But what's important about what he made is as long as it's about 6 to 8 inches deep, that's what's really important, because there are a lot of these little bee houses that are sold out and about. And they're more decorative because they're only about 2 to 3 inches deep, some of them, and they need to be about that long. And what happens is the solitary bees that I mentioned, the natives, what they'll do is they'll take pollen and they'll bring it into one of these canes, and then they lay an egg on it, and then they create a wall either with mud or a leaf, and they keep doing that. And they can put 6 to 8 or maybe more eggs into these canes, and that's where they're laying their young.
What's a cane, Donna? Sorry to interrupt there. What's
a cane? I'm sorry. I think he said he used bamboo, maybe. He said, okay, so I use the word cane. I cut down my brambles that are growing on the side of my gardens, wild raspberry or blackberry and that type of thing. So I use those canes and I cut them 6 to 8 inches long and I put them, lay them horizontally. I have a little bee hotel. And what these bees do is they go in and they eat the pith, they eat the center out of those canes. And in the case of the bamboo, they're already hollow, but that's where they go in to lay their eggs. And those larvae will probably stay there for a year before they hatch out. And that is a good way to create spaces. The downside to it is if you have too much in one space, you can draw in disease and parasites and that type of thing. So you have to be really good about keeping it clean. And it might be better, I think it sounds like the size that he was building. If you have small ones and you spread them out, that's more of a natural effect. native bees are looking for piles of brush. They're looking for stems, hollow stems from our garden. So that's why we say a lot in the fall, don't cut your stems back all the way to the ground, because that's where the bees have gone in to lay their eggs for the future generations. And we tend to clean up our gardens and make everything look pristine. And we're taking away all that life when we take away the stems and we take away the leaves.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Guilty as charged, Donna. Yeah, I hate those sort of big dry sticks sticking up. All right. So who knew? You learn something new every day. So just to super clarify, Donna, and I apologize here. So a cane is like a stick, like any sort of stick. I just want to be clear there.
Yeah, there were certain ones that are better than others. But like I said, I have wild raspberries growing all over the property. And the second year cane, like a raspberry cane, is usually very stiff, brownish in color and more stiff. And like I said, I cut them down to the ground and I'm not killing the plant. More shoots will come up for this year. But I take the old canes and I cut them 6 to 8 inches and I put them in my bee house, my bee hotel. They're basically cinder blocks stacked up. And so the opening of the cinder block is facing out and I can lay them in. And other stems that work good, you can take sticks or canes from elderberry and some woody plants, but you don't want anything that is too thin, like a hosta stem or something like that, because that's really easy for disease and parasites to penetrate those really thin stems.
Okay, well, coming up after a short break, we will talk more with our guests about what it takes to create a pollinator-friendly space. And the good news is it doesn't have to take a lot, but there is some stuff you should know, including what I just learned. Don't cut down those old dry sticks at the end of the season. Keep it right here and keep your calls coming in to 800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, supporting pollinators in your outdoor spaces, whether that's a big backyard or a flower pot on the front steps. Listeners, what are your questions about tending and maintaining pollinator-friendly plots? What are your favorite pollinators and what plants do you use to attract them? Email exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. We're talking with Emma Erler, landscape and greenhouse field specialist for UNH Cooperative Extension. Also, Donna Miller, a master gardener who runs Petals in the Pines in Canterbury and the New Hampshire Monarch Festival. And Diane DeLuca, senior biologist at New Hampshire Audubon, where she oversees pollinator conservation projects. And all of you, right back to our listeners. Susan's calling from Meriden. Hi, Susan, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to talk about, I own a larger piece of property, and so kind of the other end of the spectrum. And what I try to do is to leave my field till the very last moment to mow it so that the bees can have that last sip of, you know, especially goldenrod. So not to mow your property too early and try to keep as much in wild flowers as possible.
Wow. And Susan, is this something you've started doing recently, or have you been doing this for a long time?
I've actually been doing it for a long time. I have three beekeepers who live in my neighborhood, and we've talked about it, and it's a conscious decision.
Wow. Okay. So Emma, we did a whole show last year on sort of not mowing, moving away from the perfect lawn and so forth. I'm glad you called, Susan. And Emma, what are your thoughts there, please?
Oh, I think that's the perfect approach. And I'm so glad to hear that Susan's taking it. Having the landscape be a little bit more wild and woolly, if you will, is really the best way to support pollinators. And certainly if you have a field or a meadow, only mowing it once a year and waiting until the end of the season when there really isn't too much blooming, you know, even waiting until after a frost, when flowers have pretty much senesced, when those pollinators are looking to, you know, settle down, hibernate for the winter, that's really the best time to do it. And you know, really the best argument in general for mowing an area is just to keep woody plants from coming in. So some people that have fields and meadows may not even mow every year. They may mow every 2 years just to keep some of those shrubs from taking over, because New Hampshire wants to be woods. If we have open spaces, we do have to maintain them so that they will stay open for pollinators. But yeah, great approach. I love it. That's exactly what I would recommend. So keep up the good work.
Well, and thanks for calling, Susan. And again, our number is 800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. All of you, a caller who could not stay on the line wanted to know which specific flowers and plants to buy. And this is great. I wanted to ask all of you that as well. So Diane, to you first, what are sort of the stars in the pollinator garden at Audubon? What specific flowers and plants are just especially useful?
Well, they're probably all useful for different pollinators, but if you want something that kind of just buzzes, Anise hyssop is really wonderful for the bees, and it's long lasting, which is also nice, as Emma and Donna already mentioned. You want blooms from early in the season to late in the season, and once the Anise hyssop blooms, it tends to stay quite long into the fall. Purple comb flower is another favorite. It's really easy to grow and has long lasting blooms as well. And Emma and Donna probably have favorites as well. There are some that are a little bit more, as Emma mentioned, wild and woolly, meaning that if you're going to put them in your garden, you want to isolate them a little bit, but they are wonderful pollinator plants, something like mountain mint, and some of the monardas, the bee balm, are also wonderful pollinator flowers. If you're interested in bringing hummingbirds into your garden, Lonicera is really wonderful plant for hummingbirds, and they pretty much will visit it all day long. And so that's really fun to be able to see that. Eastern columbine is another favorite of ours at Audubon that also attracts hummingbirds because it's a tubular flower, but it's really beautiful and very long lasting.
Wow. So, that's a great starter list. And actually, Donna and Emma, I'm going to let you have another minute to think about that, because I want to go to another caller. This is Paula in Laconia. Hey, Paula, you're on the exchange. Thanks for calling us today.
Oh, good morning.
Morning.
I am a transplant from South Georgia that moved up to Laconia, and I didn't know any of the plants here. I almost pulled up lupin in my yard. But now I have started a program just because I wanted to. I'm an independent resident at Taylor Community, but it's called Celebrating Native Pollinator Gardens. And now we have a group and we meet, and I yesterday handed out lists of many of the same flowers that you mentioned. We have, and my list was for bees, butterflies, and hummingbirds. So I thought that was interesting. But the only thing they have to do is, if you want to be in this group, is you can either have a raised bed, a container garden, or a window box. And we help each other. I did a lot of research because I didn't know about flowers up here. And and we know, I know now to plant them in bunches, not just one. And so we're having a good time. We're just waiting for the weather to get better and not so cold, so that we can put our plants in. And when you finish, you get not a flag to go in your garden, because I learned that the blowing flag would scare the insects and the butterflies and the bees away. But you get a placard on a wooden stick to put in that says you have created a native pollinator garden.
Well, Paula, that's awesome. And good for you for sort of diving into your new local landscape and figuring it out and encouraging others. And I did not even think that a flapping flag might be disturbing. So thank you for sharing that. Here's another caller. This is Jackie in Goffstown. Hi, Jackie, you're on The Exchange. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
Good.
Good. I love this program. I wanted to tell a story. I have a large property, about 15 acres. I've lived there 35 years. 3 years ago, all of a sudden, having never seen a milkweed plant, I started to have milkweed coming up all over my perennial gardens, which I have a substantial number of them. I started trying to pull them up, but the root system discouraged me, so I just let it go. And that next year, this would be the second year, 2 years ago, I suddenly had an extraordinary amount of monarch caterpillars munching away on this milkweed. And then we had chrysalises over everything you could think of, the latticework, under the deck, underneath the garden hose, on plants. And we had monarch butterflies just emerging all over this period of the summer. And then the next year, not a single milkweed plant. And I thought this was sort of a weird cycle, but it taught me not to pull things up out of my garden that I don't think belong there and just let it be and let nature happen. So that's my story.
Jackie, I'm so glad you called, because Donna, I really want to hear your story of monarchs and milkweed. I mean, you, in addition to running Petals in the Pines, you run the New Hampshire Monarch Festival. So Jackie, thanks a lot. And Donna, go ahead.
Yes, great question from Jackie. And thank you for growing milkweed. I thank you on behalf of all the monarchs out there. That is their host plant. The monarch butterfly will only lay her eggs on milkweed. And that is one of the main reasons why we've seen less monarchs over the years. Is a loss of habitat, loss of milkweed across the country. The milkweed that I suspect that you had was the common milkweed, because they send roots underground and keep sending it up, and you can keep pulling it and it keeps coming. And I think it's a little unusual that you didn't have any milkweed last year. Might have been because of the drought, but I'm not sure. But what I would recommend to anyone listening out there is, if you want to grow milkweed, grow the variety called swamp milkweed. Its the scientific name is Asclepias incarnata, and it is a much more tame milkweed. It stays where you put it. It does not have that underground root system. It has a fibrous root system. It stays put. The leaves are much thinner and more succulent, and I think more favorable to the monarch. I think of the swamp milkweed as being like the prime rib, and the common milkweed being like the ground beef. So that's kind of how I compare the two.
So Donna, tell us your own story about how you kind of, you know, entered this whole world of monarchs and milkweed and so forth.
I entered this world of monarchs because when my son was in second grade, and he's now 24 years old, so this is a while ago, he received a letter from his school teacher saying, "We study monarchs in second grade, so please go look for milkweed and go look for monarch caterpillars." And I've been raising flowers and plants all my life, and it was a new thing to me, believe it or not, at that stage. And we went looking on our milkweed and found some caterpillars, and they raised them in their classroom. And I was just, you know, enthralled by it. And, you know, kids have a childlike wonder. And I felt that sense of childlike wonder by watching. You can watch a monarch go through its complete metamorphosis from an egg to a caterpillar to a chrysalis to a butterfly in just over a month. And it's a great way for kids to learn about insects. And I was learning a lot. And so I just started really, you know, planting more milkweed and watching for the monarchs. And then I became a citizen scientist with Monarch Watch. And I order little tiny tags, little stickers. And in the fall, when they're starting their fall migration, I put the stickers on the butterflies' wings. And they travel to Mexico for the migration. And the scientists gather the butterflies that don't make it through the winter down there, find the ones with the tags, and they are able to do research to determine where they came from, and they can compare it to weather and climate and that type of thing. So they can really learn a lot about the butterfly that way.
Wow. So you tag monarch butterflies, Don. I didn't even know you could do that. They're so small. Emma, I did want to give you a chance to jump in on what I asked Diane earlier. If you had to pick sort of two or three really super duper pollinator plants, what would you pick?
Ooh, well, I guess I'll focus more on shrubs because I love woody plants in the landscape. One of my favorites for the spring is spicebush. And it's a native plant that you can find growing on the edge of the woods in New Hampshire. It has these really delicate little yellow flowers that grow in clusters. And it's a good plant for pollinators. It's a larval host plant for a number of insects. And also birds really enjoy the fruits. They're really high in protein. So it's a great food source for them late summer into fall. For later in the season, if you're looking to extend that bloom, which we know is a very good thing, I also really like a plant called summer sweet or clethra. It is a plant that typically grows along like wetland edges in New Hampshire. You might find it growing on the edge of a swamp or edge of a lake or pond. And it has these really pretty white bottle brush like flowers. It's one of those plants that will be absolutely buzzing with activity when it's in full bloom, which is more like mid to late summer. And it is one that some people might get a little annoyed with if they're trying to maintain a really formal garden, because it does tend to send up suckers. So little roots, or I should say little shoots, that come up away from the main plant. But if you have it in a spot where you can just let it do its thing, it's going to do really, really well. And just to list a few others that I think are great and are worth planting would be things like sumac. There's a number of these that are native already. High bush blueberries are great. Common ninebark, winterberry holly, and some of the native viburnums like arrowwood viburnum.
Okay, well, again, if listeners are thinking, this is great, but I can't take it all in, we have so many resources on our web post for today's show that our producer, Christina Phillips, put together. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Leah wrote us an email. She says, one of the things we can definitely do is let the dandelions grow. The hummingbirds go to it as the first food when they migrate up here. Leah says, of course, using herbicides and insecticides to create a green grass lawn does no service to our environment or pollinators. An easy annual, she says, I grow every summer is the Mexican sunflower. It's a beautiful orange and bright in the garden. Not only do the hummingbirds love it, the butterflies and moths are all over it. And Leah says, of course, letting the milkweeds come up wherever they may be. Leah, thank you for writing. And coming up, we're going to talk about insects. We've got a couple listeners who want to know how to manage your pollinator-friendly yard while also dealing with unwanted visitors like pests, ticks, and mosquitoes. So we'll talk about that after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, the New Hampshire House bill known as the so-called Divisive Concepts Bill. We'll talk more about that Wednesday morning, live at 9. Today, attracting and supporting pollinators to your outdoor spaces, no matter how large or small. And listeners, what do you want to know about how to cultivate a pollinator-friendly plot? Have you changed up your lawn to feed pollinators? How did it go? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or call 800-892-6477. So we're talking with Emma Erler with UNH Cooperative Extension, also Donna Miller, a master gardener who runs Petals in the Pines in Canterbury, and Diane DeLuca, who focuses on pollinators at New Hampshire Audubon. And all of you, we have a bunch of emails from listeners who want to help pollinators but are also concerned about, you know, unwanted guests in their garden. Here's Caroline from Windham who says, how do the mosquito killing services that seem to be popular affect the bee population and other insects, which are also declining? And then Liz in Concord says, do tick tubes made with permethrin designed for clothing harm pollinators? We've talked about ticks and permethrin a lot on this show. And then Robin in Manchester says, my neighbor on one side sprays for mosquitoes and the neighbor on the other side hangs wasp traps. So these kill pollinators, Robin asks. Will this hamper my efforts to attract them? Great questions. And I think, Donna, maybe I'll go to you first, you know, trying to keep ticks out, and we've got people spraying for mosquitoes. How does that affect pollinator efforts?
Right. Well, as it was mentioned earlier, that is one of the problems with our decline in insects is definitely the entire group. When you say pesticides, we're talking herbicide, fungicide, all kinds of things. And I really am concerned about the spraying that's happening. I think there are some other alternatives. Let's talk about mosquitoes, for example. One thing, Diane mentioned Doug Tallamy earlier, and he has been promoting the use of mosquito dunks. There, you can purchase them at local garden centers or online, but it is a natural product that you can put into, you can take a pail of water and add a little bit of grass or straw and let it get nasty. And that's where the mosquitoes like to lay their eggs. And then you put a dunk in, and when the larval hatch, they will eat the dunk and it kills them. And it's killing mosquitoes and gnats and fleas, but it will not affect anything else. I've been very concerned about it. You know, will it affect frogs or toads or any other things? And it really targets the mosquito larva. So we're trying that this year. And as for ticks, in a meadow situation, somebody earlier mentioned about how she had a large meadow. What I do here is I mow a wide path through the middle so I can walk through there and enjoy it. And it's when you're walking through the tall grasses, that's usually when you're going to get ticks or in leaves. So if they're off to the side, I'm usually a little bit better protected. And I do treat, I have clothing that is treated with permethrin. So I wear that when I work outside, and I have had ticks get on it and they are not happy. They die pretty readily.
Wow. So Diane, how do you manage pests in the pollinator gardens that you're in charge of at Audubon? I'm curious about that.
Well, if we're talking about ticks and mosquitoes, so we actually have not used the dunks, but I had heard about them, and I think we might think about that for this year so that we can have more water features in the garden. We actually had a problem with mosquito larvae in there, so we took the larger water features down. In terms of ticks, our garden has walkways through it, and ticks have really not been a problem in the actual public garden space. There's certainly a problem out in the fields. And again, we have wide, as Donna mentioned, we have wide pathways that we mow through there so people can walk through. But you do need to just check yourself after you've been in those habitats, especially for ticks.
Yeah, well, and Diane, I live not too far from the Audubon, and when I'm there, I do appreciate the paths and I stay on them. I'm not going to go stomping through the fields because that is sort of asking for it. Emma, I want to throw this one at you. Barb in Goffstown writes, I too enjoy leaving the cleanup until late spring to support all the vital life in the leaves, etc. But Barb says, all those leaves are also good hiding places for voles and mice. I am overrun with both, Barb says. I frequently find mice nests and lots of vole tunnels when I clean up in spring. She asks how to balance not providing habitat for the rapidly reproducing voles and mice while supporting winter habitat for the pollinators. Wow, Barb, I had not thought of that. Go ahead, Emma.
Wow, that's a great question. Voles and mice can definitely be a big nuisance in the garden. And usually they tend to target certain plants. So bulbs can definitely be a favorite for them, as well as many woody shrubs and trees. With trees and shrubs, it's not too difficult to protect them from mice and from voles. The best thing you can do is actually to put a guard around the base. My preference is to make a guard out of hardware cloth, so like a galvanized steel mesh that you actually form a cylinder with and put that around the base of your tree, not really tight to the tree, at least an inch or so off of the trunk or the bark of that tree. That's going to prevent mice and voles from actually being able to chew on the plant. And that's pretty much all you need to do. With perennials and certainly with bulbs that these animals favor, if you have particular plants
that tend to be bothered every winter, I would be inclined to maybe do a little bit more garden cleanup in those spots. Try to keep things a bit more open so that there aren't hiding places. Your really only other option there is to try using repellents, which are only going to work so well. They're going to need to be reapplied. They're probably not going to hold up underneath the snow, or I should say they're definitely not going to. Or you could try also caging some of your perennials or your bulbs. So using that same hardware cloth, like a half inch or so gauge on the mesh, and actually planting your perennials, your bulbs inside of that. Kind of cumbersome, so not everyone's going to want to bother with that. The last thing I would suggest then is potentially if the voles are a really, really big issue on your property, is doing some trapping to control voles. But that would definitely be my last choice. So instead, I would be focusing on protecting plants.
And I'm so glad Barb wrote, because Emma, I did want to ask you, you know, a lot of our listeners who are growing, you know, flowers that support pollinators are probably also growing vegetables. And I wonder, is there a chance that attracting a whole bunch of pollinators can actually harm your vegetables? You know, attracting increased, I don't want to say pests, but insects that might also turn to the lettuce garden or the tomatoes?
Wow, that's a great question. I don't think so. No, I think the pollinators are absolutely going to be attracted to the flowers that you have in your landscape and in your vegetable garden. But I don't think they're going to attract any other insects per se, or having some pollinator plants on your property. I don't know that that's really going to attract pests. If anything, it's going to help build up your beneficial insect population. So in addition to the pollinators, there are all sorts of insect predators out there. So insects that feed on pest insects. So having a diversity of plants on your property is in general a very good thing. But of course, if you have a vegetable garden, it's almost inevitable that you're going to run into some of these vegetable pests. So things like the hornworms on tomatoes, or striped cucumber beetles, maybe on your cucurbit crops. When it comes to those sorts of pests, if you're trying to be super pollinator friendly, going out and hand picking them. So putting on gloves or just using your bare hands to actually remove those insects rather than using any sort of insecticide, which of course has the potential to impact all insects, is your best approach. And I find that particularly for beetles, you'll be most successful in catching them if you go out in the early morning when the temperature is a little bit cooler and they're moving a bit slower.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. All right. I'll have to get up a little bit earlier because I'm pretty busy in the morning, as you can imagine. Here's a great question from Marilyn, who says, how does one locate sources for buying these native plants or seeds? Donna, you want to tackle that?
Sure. Hopefully, I sent some links to some specific growers. There are some in New Hampshire who grow native plants. That's their key plant that they grow. Also, you can check at nurseries and ask for native plants. But one thing you have to be really careful of is even native plants are being bred to create cultivars or nativars, which is they are being bred for maybe some certain trait. And some of these are not as beneficial to pollinators as the pure native plant. So it's a buyer beware, do your research. Read the labels. And also, if people want to know what to grow, you asked that question earlier, we have a link to the National Wildlife Federation. They have a plant finder, and you basically just type in your zip code and up comes a list of what native plants grow in your area. And so when you're out shopping, you know, ask for these plants, ask your nurseries and, you know, if they have these plants.
Oh, that's interesting. And that gets to the caller who called in earlier, who moved here from the South and took it upon herself to sort of learn what was native and local. Diane, do you want to add anything to that as well? Sources for buying native plants or seeds?
I think Donna covered it, and there are some good resources that are on the website that will be linked. There are a couple of specific nurseries that just sell native plants that are really good resources for people, even if they just want to go and take a look and see what they have, and then potentially go to some other local places as well. A lot of the larger garden centers are now having native plant sections.
Okay, I did not know that. And I'm glad you mentioned the website, Diane, because again, the web post that Christina Phillips put together today is nhpr.org/exchange. That's where you can find it. And there's a lot of information there. Susan says, awesome show. I do try to plant pollinators. Need to plant my swamp milkweed seeds from Petals in the Pines, too. So, Donna, there you go. And all of you, it was great to talk to you. Emma, thank you for coming back on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's Emma Erler, Landscape and Greenhouse Field Specialist for UNH Cooperative Extension. Donna, thank you, too, for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me today. It was a joy.
That's Donna Miller, Master Gardener. She runs Petals in the Pines in Canterbury. And Diane, thank you, too. I'll have to come visit that pollinator garden. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Laura. I appreciate being here.
That's Diane DeLuca, Senior Biologist at New Hampshire Audubon. Today's show was produced by Exchange Senior Producer Christina Phillips. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.